only way. Except it better not fail. Zachariah turned to me.
There you are, he said. We'll do it.
On all this we shook hands, and I was soon, once again, alone in darkness. It's odd, perhaps, but I was not frightened. I assumed we could succeed with our plan. Oh, what a power of faith in justice had I then! A few days from Providence. I smiled. I would return to the life I led with my family, but now in America, where, so I had been long taught to believe, greater freedom held sway. I sat for the better part of an hour, thinking, not of what was about to happen, but of happy days ahead. I heard a sound. I started up, peering into the darkness. Zachariah, quite breathless, appeared before me.
"Charlotte," he called. "It's time."
I crawled out from the brig. Zachariah had found a small lamp, one well hooded.
"This way,"
he whispered before I could ask him anything. We moved down the hold toward the central cargo bay and its ladder. I looked up. It was quite dark above. "What time is it?" I suddenly asked.
2 bells into the mid-watch.
By sure reckoning, that meant it would be 1 o'clock at night. Couldn't we do it by daylight?
Charlotte, you're scheduled to be hanged at dawn.
My stomach rolled. My legs grew shaky. Zachariah put his hand on my arm, as if he himself had caught my fear.
"You'll do well," he said.
He closed down the lantern's hood to a mere slit and led the way up the ladder. I followed until we reached the top cargo. Once there, Zachariah signaled me toward the rear ladder. It would put me directly into the steerage before the captain's cabin. "Where will the captain be?" I whispered.
"Keach sent word that he's got him at the helm," Zachariah explained, his voice low. "He's managed to jam the wheel somehow, and called the captain for instruction. Roused him from his bed."
"How long will I have?"
"Take no more time than you need,"
was his reply. "And the rest of the crew?"
"Word on that, too. They all know and are waiting. Go on now. I'll watch for you here."
I looked at him.
"Charlotte, it's this or the Royal Yard."
I crept aloft, and soon was standing alone in the empty steerage, listening. The steady wash of waves, the bobbing and swaying of the ship, the creak and groan of timbers, all told me the Seahawk was plowing toward home in a brisk wind. By chance, the door to my old cabin was open. As it swung to and fro, it banged irregularly, rusty hinges rasping. When had I heard that sound before? What came into my mind was my first night aboard the ship, when I lay upon my bed feeling so abandoned. How frightened I'd been then! How little was there then to fear! I even remembered the voices I'd heard outside my door at that time. Who had spoken? I wondered, as though to keep myself from moving forward now. What was said? Nervously, I glanced back over a shoulder through the steerage portal. While I could not see much, the soft glow that lay upon the deck told me that it must be a full or nearly full moon. I was glad of that. It meant there would be some light to see by inside the captain's cabin. Yet, inexplicably, I remained standing there, wasting precious time, listening to my old door bang and creak, trying to rid myself of the fear that lay like heavy ballast in the pit of my stomach. A notion that I had neglected to consider something about the voices I had heard that first night. The suspicion became rather like an invisible rope that restrained me. Try though I might, I could not find how to unbind it.
A random plunge of the ship roused me to my business. Making sure the little lantern was well shielded, I moved to the door, put my hand to the handle, and pushed. It gave with ease. The room lay open before me. Dimly, I could make out its fine furnishings, even the chessboard with its pieces, exactly as I recollected them from my first visit. I lifted the lantern. There, seated at the table, was Captain Jaggery. His eyes were upon me.
"Miss Doyle," he said, "how kind of you to visit. Do please step in."
Chapter 21. He was waiting for me. All I could do was stare at him in disbelief.
"Miss Doyle," the captain said, "would you be good enough to sit?"
He rose and held an upholstered seat out for me. As the Seahawk rolled, the door behind me slammed shut. The sudden noise startled me from my daze. "You knew I was coming," I whispered, finding it impossible to raise my voice.
"Of course."
"How?" There was a slight smile on his lips. Then he said,
"Mr. Keach."
"Keach?" I echoed lamely.
"Exactly. Who, from the start, kept me well informed about the crew. How they kept other sailors from signing on, how they threatened passengers so they would not sail. He informed me about Cranach, about Zachariah. Yes, Miss Doyle, I know your friend is alive and has been hiding in the hold. I'm delighted that he keeps out of the way. No charge of murder shall be put to me, shall it? More to the point, I know about what you're doing in my cabin now. It is the business of a ship's master, Miss Doyle, to know his ship and his crew, to keep everything in order. I told you that before. Apparently it still surprises."
I stood unmoving.
"Won't you sit?"
he asked. "What do you mean to do with me?" I asked.
"You've had your trial. Was it not fair?"
"I did not kill Mr. Hollybrass."
"Was the trial fair, Miss Doyle?"
"It was you who killed him," I burst out. He remained silent for a long while. Then at last he said,
"Do you know why I despise you, Miss Doyle?"
It was said evenly, without emotion.
"Do you?"
"No," I admitted.
"The world of a ship, Miss Doyle, is a world not without quarrels," he began. "Sometimes bitter quarrels. But it is, Miss Doyle, a world that does work according to its own order. Now, when a voyage commences, all understand the rightful balance between commander and commanded. I can deal with the sailors, and they with me. I need them to run the Seahawk, just as they need me to command her. So we live by a rough understanding, they and I. And when this voyage began, I had high hopes you would help me keep the crew in order with your ladylike ways. But you, Miss Doyle, you interfered with that order. You presumed to meddle where you had no right. Look at the way you acted, the way you've dressed. It doesn't matter that you are different, Miss Doyle. Don't flatter yourself. The difficulty is that your difference encourages them to question their places, and mine, the order of things. Miss Doyle, you ask me what I intend to do. I intend to—"
"You killed Hollybrass, didn't you?" I now demanded.
"I did."
"Why?"
"He threatened me," the captain said with a shake of his head. "And in the midst of that storm, it was intolerable."
"And then you decided to put the blame on me," I pressed, "to keep me from going to the authorities and telling them the truth about you."
"Who shall be blamed for this disastrous voyage?" he asked. "It cannot be me, can it? No, it must be someone from the outside, The unnatural one. To preserve order, Miss Doyle, sacrifices must always be made. You.
Am I a sacrifice? I demanded.
In all honesty, I wished you had broken your own neck, falling from the rigging or on the bowsprit. You did not. As it stands, we should reach Providence in a few days. It is crucial that when we make landfall, I be firmly established as master. Mr. Hollabrass had to die. No one could possibly believe I would do such a thing. So, yes, since you are unnatural, proclaimed so, I hasten to remind you, by all, you shall be held responsible. Thus is our world set right again.
I still hadn't moved. Ignoring me now, he proceeded to light some candles. A soft yellow glow filled the room.
Look, he said.
Puzzled, I gazed about the cabin. I saw now what I had not seen before in the light of the moon. In the candlelight, I could see that much of the furniture was cracked. Many legs had splints. Upholstery was water-stained. Frames on the walls hung crookedly. Some had pictures missing. Maps and papers on the table were wrinkled or sadly torn. The tea service on the table was dented and tarnished, but arranged and presented as whole. The chess pieces were, I now realized, no more than salt and pepper shakers, broken cups, bent candlesticks. I looked at him again. He was gazing at me as if nothing had happened.
It was the storm that destroyed much of it, he said. I have spent considerable time in setting the room to rights. Have I not done well? Order, Miss Doyle. Order is all. Take away the light, and...
He leaned over and blew the candles out.
You see? It's hard to notice the difference. Everything appears in order.
You're... mad, I said, finally able to respond to the man.
On the contrary, Miss Doyle, I am the soul of reason. And to prove my reasonableness, I'm going to give you some choices. You came to my cabin, Miss Doyle, to steal the key to the guns. Is that not so?
I didn't know what to say.
You don't have to admit to it. I know it's so. Mr. Keach has informed me about everything.
Even as he spoke, he reached into his jacket pocket and drew out a key.
Here is the key you wanted, he said,
tossing it so that it landed by my feet.
Take it up, Miss Doyle, he said. Go to the cabinet. Take out any one of the muskets. All are loaded. I will sit here. You may carry out the plan you and Zachariah concocted. You must know that I will be murdered. But, Miss Doyle, do not doubt for an instant that the world will learn your part in this. Do you think these sailors will keep quiet? No. Open that cabinet and you let out scandal. Horror. Ruination. Not just you. Your family. Your father. His firm. So before you do that, consider another choice.
He walked to the far corner of his cabin and picked up what looked like a bundle of clothing. He dumped it at my feet. I saw by the light of my lantern that it was the garments I had set aside weeks ago, a lifetime ago, it seemed, for my disembarkation. White dress, stockings, shoes, gloves, bonnet. All in perfect order.
Put these back on, Miss Doyle, he said. Resume your place and station. Publicly renounce your ways. Beg me for mercy before the crew, and I... You have my word. I will grant it. All will be restored to its proper balance. Like my cabin furnishings, a little dented and torn, perhaps, but in the diminished light, no one need know. All reputation saved. Of course, there is a third choice. You had your trial. A verdict was reached. You could accept that verdict and be hanged. I'll even invent a story for your family. Some sickness, an accident. The hurricane. So, yes, the hanging is one of your choices. Now, what shall it be?
He clasped his hands, sat again in his chair, and waited. Out on the deck, three bells rang.
What if I don't accept any of them?
He hesitated.
Miss Doyle, I thought I made it clear. There are no other choices.
You're wrong, I said. And so saying, I turned and rushed out of his cabin, along the steerage and into the waist of the ship. There was, as I had guessed, a full moon. It sat high in a sky of darkest blue, amidst shadowy, scudding clouds. The sails on the forward mast were full, and fluttered with the tension of the wind. The sea hissed about the bow as the Seahawk rushed ahead. In a line upon the forecastle deck, the crew had gathered and were looking down at me. When I turned to look at the quarterdeck, I saw Keech there, not far from the splintered stump of the mainmast. Near him was Zachariah, his hands bound before him. It took but a moment for me to realize that our entire conspiracy had been overthrown and turned against us. I stepped forward. Behind me, I heard Captain Jaggery at his door. I took a quick look. He had a pistol in his hand. As he emerged, I moved hastily across the deck. For a moment, all stood still, as if each were waiting for the other to move first. It was Captain Jaggery who broke the silence.
"There stands your shipmate," he proclaimed shrilly to the crew. "She crept into my cabin, and would have murdered me in my sleep if I had not awakened and managed to wrest away this pistol. Not enough to have murdered Mr. Hallibras, she would have murdered me. I tell you, she would murder you all." "It was Zachariah there," the captain continued to rant, "hiding, pretending injury to keep from work, who let her out and set her on this murderous plot. She had her trial. She had her verdict, to which you all agreed. Only just now I gave her yet another way to release herself from the punishment of hanging. I begged her to put on her proper dress, and told her I would find the heart to forgive. This she refused." "He's lying," I called out. "He's trying to save himself. He's the one who killed Hallibras. He's admitted it." "She's the one who lies," the captain cried, pointing his pistol now at me, now toward the crew, which made them visibly flinch. "The truth is, she wants to take over the ship. Yes, she does. Would you stand for that? Do you wish to put into port and have this girl spread the slander that she, a girl, took command of this ship, took over each and every one of you, and told you what to do? A girl! Would you ever be able to hold your heads up in any port, in any part of the world? Think of the shame of that!"
I had begun to edge toward the steps to the forecastle deck, thinking the men there would stand behind me. But as I approached, none moved forward. I stopped.
"You mustn't believe him," I begged them. "Don't be afraid of her," Captain Jaggery cried. "Look at her. She's nothing but an unnatural girl. A girl trying to act like a man, trying to be a man. She can only harm you by living. Let her have her punishment."
I started up the forecastle steps. The men began to back away. Horrified, I paused. I sought out Barlow, Ewing, Grimes, Fisk. Each in turn seemed to shrink from my look. I turned back. Captain Jaggery fingered the pistol in his hand.
"Take her," he commanded.
But that far they would not go. And the captain, who saw this as soon as I, now began to advance toward me himself. I backed away from him until I was atop the forecastle deck. The line of crew had split, some to either side.
"Help me,"
I appealed to them again. But though they were deaf to Captain Jaggery, they were equally deaf to me. The captain, in careful pursuit, now slowly mounted the steps to the forecastle. I retreated into the bow, past the capstan, on a line with the cathead. He kept coming. Against the moon, he seemed to be a faceless shadow, a shadow broken only by the dagger-like glitter of the pistol that caught the light of the moon. My heart hammered so I could hardly breathe. I looked for a way to escape, but found none. The bow seemed to dance under my feet. Frantically, I looked behind me. There was little space now between me and the sea. Still, the captain closed in. I scrambled back high into the forepeak. He stopped, braced his legs wide, extended his arm and pistol. I could see his hand tighten. The bow plunged. The deck bucked. He fired all the same. The shot went wide, and in a rage he flung the pistol at me. I stumbled backward, tripped. He made a lunge at me. But I, reacting with more panic than reason, scrambled down onto the bowsprit itself, grabbing at the back rope to keep from falling. Clinging desperately to the rope, for the ship plunged madly again, I kept edging further out onto the bowsprit, all the while looking back at Captain Jaggery. In the next moment, he scrambled after me. I pushed past the trembling sails. Below, the sea rose and fell. Vaguely, I sensed that the crew had rushed forward to watch what was happening. There was no more back rope to hold to, and the captain continued to inch forward, intent on pushing me off. There were only a few feet between us. With a snarl, he lunged at me with both hands. Even as he did, the Seahawk plunged. In that instant, Captain Jaggery lost his footing. His arms flew wide, but he was teetering off balance and began to fall. One hand reached desperately out to me. With an instinctive gesture, I jumped toward him. For a brief moment, our fingers linked and held. Then the ship plunged again, and he tumbled into the waves. The ship seemed to rear up. For one brief interval, Captain Jaggery rose from the sea, his arm gripped in the foaming beak of the figurehead. Then, as if tossing him off, the Seahawk leaped, and Captain Jaggery dropped into the roaring foam and passed beneath the ship, not to be seen again. Weak, trembling, soaking wet, I made my way back along the bowsprit until I could climb into the forepeak. The crew parted before me, no one saying a word. I stopped and turned. "Give me a knife," I said. Grimes took one from his pocket. I hurried across the deck to where Zachariah still stood. Keech had fled his side. I cut the rope that bound Zachariah and then embraced him as he did me. Finally, he walked to the quarterdeck rail. As if summoned, the crew gathered below.
"Shipmates," Zachariah cried, "it's needful that we have a captain. Not Keech, for he was an informer and should be in the brig. But Miss Doyle here has done what we could not do. Let her be captain now."
Chapter 22. Captain in name, perhaps, but not in practice. I was too aware of all I had yet to learn for that. Besides, as Zachariah would acknowledge later, the fact that I was the daughter of an officer in the company that owned the Seahawk was no small factor in my formal elevation. It would preserve the niceties. But though I was entered into the log as captain, I wrote it there myself, it was Zachariah who took true command. I insisted, and no one objected. The crew chose their mates, Fisk and Barlow, and assembled themselves into two watches, and managed well enough. Johnson was more than happy to return to the forecastle. "Regarding Captain Jaggery," the log read simply, "at the crew's urging, I wrote that our noble captain had kept his post at the wheel during the hurricane, only to be swept away in the storm's final hour. Mr. Hollibrass was afforded the same heroic death.
I have been skeptical of accounts of deceased heroes ever since. Though Fisk and Barlow insisted I move into the captain's quarters, I continued to work watch and watch as before. In between, I wrote furiously in my journal, wishing to set down everything. It was as if, only by reliving the events in my own words, could I believe what had happened. Within 24 hours of Captain Jaggery's death, Morgan threw the line, pulled up a plug of black sand, tasted of it, and announced, "Block Island." We would reach Providence, assuming the wind held, in no more than 48 hours. Indeed, 12 hours later, the mainland was sighted, a thin, undulating ribbon of green-gray between sea and sky. There was much rejoicing among the crew about this, and their grand expectations once they were ashore. As for me, I found myself suddenly plunged into instant and to me inexplicable melancholia.
"What ails our Captain Doyle?"
Zachariah asked, using the term he had taken to teasing me with. He'd discovered me up at the forepeak, morosely watching the sea and the coast toward which we were drawing ever closer. I shook my head.
"It's not many, alas," he reminded me, "who boards a ship as passenger and eases into port as captain."
"Zachariah," I said, "what shall become of me?"
"Why, now I shouldn't worry. You've told me your family is wealthy. A good life awaits you. And, Charlotte, you've gained the firm friendship of many a Jack here, not to speak of memories the young rarely have. It has been a voyage to remember."
"Where is your home?" I asked suddenly.
"The east coast of Africa."
"Were you ever a slave?"
"Not I," he said proudly.
"And did you want to become a sailor?" That question he didn't answer right away. But when he did, he spoke in a less jovial tone.
"I ran away from home," he said.
"Why?"
"I was young. The world was big. My home was small."
"Did you ever go back?" He shook his head. "Never long to?"
"Oh, yes, often. But I didn't know if I would be welcome, or what I would find. Do you remember, Charlotte, what I first told you when you came aboard? That you, a girl, and I, an old black man, were unique to the sea?"
"Yes."
"The greater fact is," he said, "I am unique everywhere."
"And I?"
"Who can say now?" he answered. "I can only tell you this, Charlotte. A sailor chooses the wind that takes the ship from a safe port." "Ah, yes. But once you're abroad, as you have seen, winds have a mind of their own. Be careful, Charlotte. Careful of the wind you choose."
"Zachariah," I asked, "won't anyone in Providence ask what happened?"
"The thing we'll do," he replied, "is remind the owners that we managed to bring the Seahawk into port with their cargo intact. True, we lost captain and first mate, but they died, don't you see, doing their duty."
"Won't Keach talk?"
"Too grateful that we spared his life. Beside, Jaggery had some hold on him, blackmail. So Keach is free of that, too."
"Cranick?"
"Never on board." "I promise you, Charlotte," he concluded, "the owners will be sorrowful for all the loss, but their tears won't be water enough to float a hat."
Almost 2 months after we left Liverpool, we entered Narragansett Bay and slowly beat our way up to Providence. And on the morning of August 17th, 1832, we warped into the India docks. When I realized that we were going to dock, I went to my cabin and excitedly dressed myself in the clothes I had kept for the occasion.
bonnet over my mangled hair. Full, if somewhat ragged, skirts. Shoes rather less than intact. Gloves more gray than white. To my surprise, I felt so much pinched and confined, I found it difficult to breathe. I glanced at my trunk, where I had secreted my sailor's garb as a tattered memento. For a moment I considered changing back to that, but quickly reminded myself that it must, from then on, remain a memento. As the rope secured us, I looked upon the dock and, with a beating heart, saw my family among the waiting throng. There were my father and mother, brother and sister, all searching up for me. They were as I remembered them, prim, overdressed, despite the dreadful summer heat. My mother was in a full skirt the color of dark green, with a maroon shawl about her shoulders and a bonnet covering most of her severely parted hair. My father, the very image of a man of property, was frock-coated, vested, top-hatted, his mutton chops a gray bristle. My brother and sister were but little miniatures of them. Truly, I was glad to see them, and yet I found that I struggled to hold back tears. Farewells to the crew were all too brief, carefully restrained. The real goodbyes had been spoken the night before. Tears from Barlow, a gruff hug from Fisk, kisses to my cheeks from Ewing. "You're my mermaid now, lass," he whispered. An offer, with a sly grin, of a splicing knife from Grimes, refused. A round of rum toasted by Foley, topped out with three huzzas from all. Then came the final midnight watch with Zachariah, during which time he held my hand, and I, unable to speak, struggled to keep my tumbling emotions within. Now I marched down the gangway into the careful embrace of both my parents. Even my brother Albert and sister Evelina offered little more than sigh-like kisses that barely breathed upon my face. We settled into the family carriage. "Why is Charlotte's dress so tattered?" Evelina asked. "It was a difficult voyage, dearest," my mother answered for me.
"And her gloves are so dirty," Albert chimed in.
"Albert," Papa reproved him. But then, after we'd gone on a pace in silence, my mother said, "Charlotte, your face is so very brown." "The sun was hot, Mama."
"I would have thought you'd stay in your cabin," she chided, "reading edifying tracts."
Only the clip-clop of the horses could be heard. I looked past the brim of my bonnet. I found my father's eyes hard upon me, as if plumbing secrets. I cast down my eyes.
"A difficult voyage, my dear," he asked at last. "You were dismasted."
"There was a terrible storm, Papa," I said, appealing to him with my eyes. "Even Fisk, the sailors, called it one of the worst they'd ever experienced. We lost the captain and the first mate." "God in his mercy," I heard Mama whisper.
"Well, yes, I'm sure," my father offered. "But one must be careful about the words we choose, Charlotte. It's well known that sailors have an unhealthy tendency toward exaggeration. I look forward to reading a more sober account in your journal. You did keep it as you were bidden, did you not?"
"Yes, Papa." My heart sank. I had completely forgotten he would want to see what I'd written.
"I'm greatly desirous of reading it."
He wagged a finger at me playfully.
"But mind, I shall be on the lookout for spelling mistakes."
Then, thank heavens, Albert and Evelina insisted upon telling me about our fine house on Benevolent Street. It was bigger than I remembered. Great columns graced the doorway. Huge draped windows, like owl eyes, faced the street. Its full two stories put me in mind of an English fortress. Then we were safely inside, standing in the large foyer before the grand stairway.
It seemed immense to me. And dark. Cut off, after so many days, from sun and air. With my father looking on, Mama gently removed my bonnet. When she saw my mangled hair, she gasped. "Charlotte," she whispered, "what happened?" "Lice," I heard myself saying, one of the few explanations I'd rehearsed. She gasped again, and before I could restrain her, took up my hands in pity. "Poor girl," she whispered, "such awfulness." Even as she stood there, holding my hands, a strange look passed across her face. Slowly she turned my hands over, gazed at the palms, then touched them with her fingertips. "And your hands," she asked in horror, "they are so hard." I had to do my own washing, Mama." "Dear Charlotte, I am so frightfully sorry."
"Mother," Papa suddenly said, "perhaps we should move on to our breakfast together."
He offered me his arm. I took it gratefully. We walked into the dining room. The table was laid with white cloth, fine china plate, and silver. Breaking from Father, I started to sit.
"Let your mother sit first, my dear," I heard him murmur.
As we began to eat, my father said,
"Am I to understand, Charlotte, as the shipping agent informed me, that those other families, the ones who had promised to be with you during the voyage, never fulfilled their pledge?"
"No, Papa," I answered. "They never came to the ship." "How dreadfully lonely for you," my mother said, shaking her head sadly. 2 months with no one to talk to," Evelina exclaimed. "Of course I talked, silly."
"But to whom?" Albert asked in puzzlement.
"The men? The sailors?"
"The men, Charlotte?" my mother said with a frown.
"Well, you see..." "You mean the captain, do you not, Charlotte?"
my father suggested.
"Oh, no, not just him, Papa. You see, a ship is so small..."
Suddenly my father interjected.
"We seem to be lacking butter."
"I'll get it," I said, pushing back my chair.
"Charlotte, sit," my father barked. He turned to the maid who was waiting nearby. "Mary, butter."
The maid curtsied and went out. When I turned back around, I found my sister staring at me.
"What is it?"
I asked.
"I just thought of what you look like," Evelina said.
"What?" She wrinkled her nose.
"An Indian."
Albert laughed.
"Children,"
my father cried. With much effort, Albert and Evelina sat still.
"Charlotte," I heard my mother ask, "how did you pass your time?"
"Mama, you have no idea how much work there is on..." My father abruptly took out his watch.
"It's much later than I thought," he said. "Evelina and Albert have their lesson in the nursery. Miss Van Rogoff, their tutor, will be waiting. Children?"
Now struggling to suppress their giggles, Albert and Evelina rose from their seats.
"You may go now,"
my father said to them. Once they had gone, the room became very quiet. My mother was looking at me as if I were a stranger. My father's gaze was his most severe. "The sailors were very kind to me," I offered. "I could hardly be expected..."
"You must be fatigued," he cut in. "I think some rest would do you some good."
"I'm very awake, Papa. I mean, I've grown used to very little sleep, and..."
"Charlotte," he insisted, "you are tired and wish to go to your room."
"But..."
"Charlotte, you mustn't contradict your father,"
my mother whispered. I rose from my seat. "I don't know where my room is," I said.
"Mary," my father called, "ask Bridget to come in."
Mary appeared in a moment with another maid, a girl not very much older than I.
"Bridget," my father said, "take Miss Charlotte to her room. Help her with her bathing and change of clothes."
"Yes, sir."
Bridget led the way. My room was on the right side of the house, on the second floor. Its windows faced the rear garden, where a trellis of roses were in radiant bloom. I stood at the windows, gazing down on the earth and flowers, and told myself again and again, "This is home. This is home." I heard a sound behind me. A man, yet another servant, I assumed, brought in my trunk and opened it. Then he left. I went back to staring out the window. "If you please, miss," I heard Bridget say, "your father said I was to bathe and dress you." "Bridget, my name is not Miss, it's Charlotte." "I'll not be wanting to take the liberty, miss." I turned to face her. "Even if I want you to?" "I don't think the master would approve, miss." "But if I asked you—" "Not wishing to be impertinent, miss," Bridget said in a barely audible voice, "but it's master who pays my wages." I looked into her eyes. Bridget looked down. I felt a pain gather about my heart. There was a soft knock on the door. "Shall I answer it, miss?" Bridget whispered. "Yes, please," I said with great weariness. Bridget opened the door to the other maid, Mary. Mary entered and curtsied.
"Miss," she said to me, "master asked that Bridget take and destroy all your old clothing, miss. He also requests that I bring your journal down to him, miss."
I looked at the two of them, the timidity of their postures, the unwillingness to engage me with their eyes. "Mary," I said, "that is your name, isn't it?"
"Yes, miss."
"Would you call me Charlotte if I asked you to? Be my friend." Mary stole a nervous glance at Bridget.
"Would you?" "I shouldn't think so, miss."
"But why?" I pleaded.
"Master wouldn't have it, miss. I should be dismissed."
I could not reply. Then, after a moment, Mary said,
"I'll be happy to take the journal down now, miss."
"Shall I fetch it, miss?" Bridget asked me.
I went to the trunk, found the book, and gave it to Mary. She curtsied, and without another word, and still avoiding my look, stepped soundlessly from the room, shutting the door behind her. I went back to the window.
"Shall I assume that all the clothes in the trunk, miss, are old?"
Bridget asked finally. "What will happen to them?"
"Give them to the poor, I should think, miss. Mistress is very kind that way."
"There is one thing I must preserve," I had the wits to tell her. Hurriedly, I removed my sailor's clothing.
"Are those to be kept, miss?"
Bridget asked in puzzlement. "I wish to show them to my parents," I lied.
"Very good, miss."
My trunk was unpacked. I bathed. How strange that was! The filth fairly floated off. I dressed, helped, or rather interfered with, despite my protestations, by Bridget. But instead of going downstairs, I dismissed her, then sat on my bed, marveling at its softness. In truth, I was trying to compose myself. I was afraid to go downstairs. A call, I knew, would come soon enough. But, as I sat there, a memory came of my first moments upon the Seahawk. How alone I felt then. How alone I was now. "Oh, Zachariah," I whispered to myself, "where are you? Why don't you come for me?" It was my father's call that came, but not before 2 hours had passed. Mary returned with a request that I go directly to the parlor. With a madly beating heart, I started down the broad carpeted stairs, my hand caressing the highly polished balustrade. Before the massive doors to the room, I paused and drew breath. Then I knocked.
"Come in,"
I heard my father say. I entered. My mother was seated in a chair. My father was by her side, standing with his legs slightly apart, as if bracing himself. A hand gripped one of his jacket lapels. The other hand rested protectively on Mama's shoulder. She stared down at the carpet.
"Charlotte," my father said, "please shut the door behind you."
I did so.
"Now come stand before us."
"Yes, Papa." I advanced to the place indicated by my father's pointed finger. Only then did I notice that the room, even for an August midday, was uncommonly warm. I glanced toward the fireplace and was startled to see a blaze there. It took me another moment to realize that my journal was being consumed by flames. I made a move toward it.
"Stop," my father cried. "Let it burn."
"But..."
"To ash."
I turned to them in disbelief.
"Charlotte," my father began, "I have read your journal carefully. I have read some of it, not all, to your mother. I could say any number of things, but in fact will say only a few. When I have done, we shall not speak of any of this again. Is that understood?"
"But..."
"Is it understood, Charlotte?"
"Yes, Papa."
"When I sent you to the Barrington School for Better Girls, I had been, I believed, reliably informed that it would provide you with an education consistent with your station in life, to say nothing of your expectations and ours for you. I was deceived. Somehow your teachers there filled your mind with the unfortunate capacity to invent the most outlandish, not to say unnatural, tales."
"Papa," I tried to cut in.
"Silence," he roared.
I closed my mouth.
"What you have written is rubbish of the worst taste, stuff for penny dreadfuls, beneath contempt. Just as Charlotte is poorly served when you speak ill of your betters, such as poor Captain Jaggery. More to the point, Charlotte, your spelling is an absolute disgrace. Never have I seen such abominations. And the grammar, it is beyond belief. An American tutor, miss, shall instill a little order in your mind. But the spelling, Charlotte, the spelling!"
"Papa!"
"That is all we have to say on the subject, Charlotte. All we shall ever say. You may return to your room, and you will wait there until you are summoned again."
I turned to go.
"Charlotte?"
I stopped, but did not turn.
"You are forbidden. Forbidden to talk about your voyage to your brother and sister."
My wait to be called was a long one. The simple truth is, I was not allowed to leave my room. All meals were brought by Mary on a tray. I was permitted no callers, not even Albert or Evelina. "She's seriously ill," people were told. And no matter how much I tried, Bridget, the one person I saw with any regularity, would not yield to my efforts of friendship. From my mother I received little comfort, but many tears. From my father, a vast quantity of books that he deemed suitable for my reclamation. Not a word, not a question, to console me. But I did not read. Instead, I used the books, the blank pages, the margins, even the mostly empty title pages, to set down secretly what had happened during the voyage. It was my way of fixing all the details in my mind forever. 1 week had passed in this fashion when I thought to ask Bridget for a newspaper.
"I'll have to request it of Master," she replied.
"Bridget," I told her, "for every day you bring a newspaper without informing my father, I shall give you a gift." Bridget gazed at me. After a momentary search of my vanity table, I selected a pearl-headed hairpin and held it up. "Like this," I said. She complied with my request. Within a week, I found what I was searching for under the listing of Departures for Europe. Brig Seahawk, to sail on September the 9th, by the morning's tide. Captain Roderick Fisk, master. For the next few days, I made such a show of concentrating hard on my books that I was finally permitted to have my evening meals with the family downstairs. On September the 8th, surely one of the longest days I can remember, I informed everyone at table that I wished to be excused to continue the reading that was so occupying me. "What are you studying, my dear?" my mother asked nervously. "Dr. Dillard's essay on patients, Mama." "How very gratifying," she said. Later that evening, I was informed that my father wished me to come to his study. I went down and knocked on his door. "Enter," he called. He was sitting in his reading chair, an open book before him. He looked up, closed his book, and drew me forward with a gentle gesture of his hand. "You are making progress, Charlotte," he said. "I wish to commend you. I do."
"Thank you, Papa."
"You are young, Charlotte," he told me. "The young are capable of absorbing many shocks and still maintaining an—"
he searched for the proper words. "An orderly life," I offered. He smiled the first smile I had seen in a long while.
"Yes, exactly, Charlotte. Orderly. You give me much hope. You and I now understand each other perfectly. Good night, my dear girl. Good night."
He took up his book again. "Good night, Papa." I bathed. I let Bridget supervise my going to bed. By 2 o'clock in the morning, all was perfectly still. I slipped out of bed, and from the bottom drawer of my bureau took from beneath my paper-layered frocks the sailor's clothes that Zachariah had made me. I changed into them. I opened the window to my room. It was child's play for me to climb down the trellis. I almost laughed. Within half an hour I was on the India docks, standing before the Seahawk, dark except for a lantern fore and aft. A new mainmast had been stepped. As I watched from the shadow of some bales of goods, I saw someone on watch, pacing the quarter-deck. At one point, he proceeded to the bell and rang out the time, 4 bells. Each clang sent shivers up and down my spine. Boldly now, I walked up the gangplank.
"Who is that?" came a challenge.
I said nothing.
"Who is that?"
came the demand again. Now I was certain of the voice. "Zachariah," I called. My voice choked.
"Charlotte?"
"I've decided to come home." By morning's tide and a southwest wind, the Seahawk sailed away. As it did, I was clinging to the topgallant spar below a billowing royal yard. Something Zachariah told me filled my mind and excited my heart.
"A sailor," he said, "chooses the wind that takes the ship from safe port. But winds have a mind of their own."
The End. You've been listening to The True Confessions of Charlotte Doyle by Avi. Narrated by Alexandra Okarma. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Something Upstairs, also by Avi and narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalogue, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.